This is the time that was set for Phillips versus State of Nevada. And I guess the first question, are we ready to proceed at this time?
We are, Your Honor. I must apologize to the court. This did not make my calendar. I had appellate division notify my team some time ago, and somehow I'm going to read my calendar this morning to appear on the board. I've been in front of Judge Randall for the past 2 hours, so I apologize to the court. Appellant is ready.
Please proceed.
May it please this honorable court, Mr. Stanton. This case is emblematic of a problem that we have, at least in the 8th Judicial District, and that is that there is a continuous and constant rush to get cases done and through the system. Most of the errors that the appellant cites in this case are a result of a hurry up, let's get it done mentality. That it's infected all of us. Everyone in the 8th Judicial District suffers from this. Just as an edification for the court this morning, I will be arguing the issues involving the inadmissibility of the photos, the verdict form on intoxication, and prosecutorial misconduct. So if you have questions in those areas, otherwise Mr. Erickson, my co-counsel, will be arguing the remainder of the issues for the court. As to the photos, when I looked at the photos for the first time in this case, I was shocked. Now, since there's modern technology and digital photography, the crime scene investigators go out and they do a spray. They just shoot rapid, and there literally are hundreds of pictures. In the old days, when we had film and it was expensive to develop, they were much more judicious about the pictures that they would take. So the downside is that there are so many more pictures to look at. The upside is there are so many more pictures to look at because you can actually pick and choose ones that satisfy what you need to have them be admissible. When I saw what the court was going to allow in this case, I thought to myself, if not this case, which case? And that is, if it is not an error to allow these particular pictures to be in front of a jury on this kind of case, which case could it be?
But how do we decide that? I have been in the trenches for 20 years and had some success in knocking out some pictures. And you're right, we didn't have as many pictures that were offered by the state in murder cases that I did. But how do we decide as an appellate court? What was Judge Delaney not admit some and admit others? I mean, how do we decide as an appellate court?
Actually, all of the pictures that were requested by the state after we had made a timely objection to the pictures, all of the pictures that were objected to by the defense were admitted into the case.
So how do we decide as an appellate court?
As an appellate court, I apologize.
Yes, go ahead.
Because there's no record in this particular case as to how the trial court judge reached her conclusion that they should be admitted. I can't answer that other than to say then if this court is going to look de novo at those pictures, then it goes back to the old test of is it more inflammatory than it is probative. And to answer that question, what are the issues? And the issues here are, did the people burn up in a car? Because those were really the most heinous pictures that were admitted at trial. So, how do you prove, and what is necessary to prove that these people burned up in a car? And quite honestly, we all know what that means. We don't really need to see a picture of it. So, to answer the question of how probative is that picture, not a whole lot. How inflammatory is that picture? These were literally pictures that a special effects artist would spend weeks on to shock an audience if this were a movie. These are horrible pictures.
Now, let me ask you this. Granted, they're horrible pictures, but the judge specifically asked why it was necessary to have these pictures admitted. And we review this for an abuse of discretion for admitting these photographs. So why was it an abuse of discretion? There was an opportunity to vet why they were necessary.
Justice Perry, my honest answer has to be I don't know how to argue the abuse of discretion because there's no record made in this particular case. Without the record as to what thought process the trial court was going through to allow the admission of these photographs, do we know with any certainty what factor she was looking at in her mind that made this more probative than inflammatory?
Well, Mr. Langford, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to follow in.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to follow up. There was specific determinations of the state justified every photograph, from my understanding, when the judge asked that question. So why isn't that determinative?
Because we don't know that, in fact, she adopted the state's argument, or if, in fact, she'd come up with another argument. If we're going to say, all right, let's just say that all she would say is the state's argument controls, then again we come back to, that if not this case, what case is it where there's an abuse of discretion?
Okay, and that just leads me, assuming for the sake of argument that we agree with you that it is cumulative, it is prejudicial, why isn't it harmless error?
Because in this particular case, where there was a defense of self-defense and a legitimate self-defense.
This was all on video.
Sure, the what took place is on video. But we don't have audio saying what was taking place in the car. This was a contested case where a defense was mounted. It wasn't some other guy did it or something. We knew from the beginning that that video was what the video was. But the video showed self-defense, and that's what we argued to the jury. If you come out then and show these really horrible pictures, a jury is less likely. That's the whole point of prejudicial versus probative.
Sure.
They're prejudiced against the defendant in the case.
Thank you.
The verdict form. We had requested an intoxication verdict form. I think the brief, I'll submit it on the brief absent questions. To the prosecutorial misconduct argument, the state in their answering brief puts in...
Before you move on to that, why doesn't McNamara control and defeat your argument on the verdict form?
Because in this particular case, we did have so much evidence of the intoxication.
Okay, but I thought your objection was that the verdict form did not include a lesser included that it should have.
I think, I'm sorry, I misspoke. I said verdict form. I meant jury instruction.
I see.
I'm so sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes,
please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No. As to the prosecutorial misconduct, quickly. The state quotes what took place. But they put in an ellipsis, and then they put in a bit. This is where the paragraph should be, citing to their brief. If you were to elect that the murder of Kincherry would result in a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, and you elect that same punishment should be imposed for the murder of Michael Bolton, and that verdict would result in exactly no additional days in prison for the death and murder of Michael Bolton, at that point I objected. And it was a timely objection. And I knew what I was going to argue, and I argued the law. And the judge sustained my objection. The response from the state, who was standing at the podium, was an immediate, and the same would exist for Sandra Sutton. There is a pause, and I suggest a new paragraph. That, and the same applies for Sandra Sutton, is saying, one more time, I'm going to hit what the judge has already told me not to say. Did she sustain the objection? That's prosecutorial misconduct to do that. The court did not give a cautioning instruction, a curative instruction, and that made the misconduct all the more important for this court to note. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my co-counsel unless there are questions.
May it please the court, I'm going to focus on the jury verdict. And just a little background. From our perspective, this was a very, very close guilt phase trial. I don't know how much you at this point have looked at or followed the statement of facts, but...
But sir, may I ask, how close a guilt phase was this? The defendant here was not confronted ever by the victims, left the hotel, chased him down with a gun, and shot at the car. How closely contested are these facts?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that analysis because of this. The video and what was argued very thoroughly at the trial was that Mr. Harris had been involved in a confrontation at the area hotel prior to this event. It's caught on video. You see the argument. Then there's a major fight between a number of people out in the valet area, and what was thought to be one of the victims goes to his car, gets a gun. It comes out that a gun was introduced when Mr. Harris wasn't there. Mr. Harris hears about this from the girls in his car. He takes out a handgun that is in his glove box, gives it to his girlfriend, tells her, because he's going back into the hotel because he can't find his jacket. He gives her the gun and says, if anybody, you know, basically defend yourself if something happens because all this fighting is going on. He goes back in to look for his coat, comes back out, gets in his vehicle.
Now, at that point, the victim's gone already.
No, Your Honor, and that is the big issue. These victims circle around three or four times in this valet area. From our perspective, it was...
While he's getting his jacket?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is clear in the video. You see this car, the Maserati, come back around a number of times, leave, come back, and it's our position is because they thought Mr. Harris was going to leave sooner, but he goes back in to get his coat, and so there's a delay, and they're coming back to figure out why he's held up. So then he comes, gets in his vehicle, leaves, and as he is leaving, the Maserati jumps out of the traffic lanes, gets in front of his car because he's at a stoplight. You see them, the driver yelling, you don't know what it's being said, but he's yelling something at Mr. Harris and then speeds off. Mr. Harris then comes up to the next stoplight. And at that point, the Maserati comes up next to him. He's in a slower vehicle. He tries to accelerate, but he cannot run the Maserati. It catches back up to him. And then shortly after there, the shooting begins. So from our perspective, he's already been told that someone had gone and gotten a gun. He is telling people to be, you know, here's a gun in case you need to defend yourself. And from our perspective, this clearly had strong issues of self-defense, or at least lesser than a first-degree murder allegations in the facts of this case. And that brings us back to all of these errors that we think, many of which are very significant. The jury verdict form was not provided to us, and I'm breathing a little heavy. The judge, the night before closing, she was still wrestling with whether or not she was going to allow our voluntary manslaughter instruction. Unbeknownst to us, she does finally agree that we get to introduce that, and then she puts in the record that she never shows anyone the verdict form. There have been other verdict forms that have been presented, but her office prepared a verdict form that was given to the jury before either the prosecution or the defense ever saw it.
Was the jury instructed on voluntary manslaughter?
Yes, Your Honor.
But they didn't get a verdict form.
Correct. Correct. And we have cited, I would argue, at length, a number of various cases that are right on point, I think, as to the effect of a jury a verdict form that is an error. And
but what do you do with the old Nevada precedent and McNamara in this setting? The jury was told of what it needed to find in order to find him guilty at first and so on and so forth in the instructions. But under McNamara, would this not be not a problem?
Your Honor, I would submit that in this type of case, and one of the main cases we cite to on this issue is the Beck versus Alabama. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1980 that talks about the, and in that case it was a Georgia case that did not include a lesser included offense in a capital murder trial, and we quoted at length the Supreme Court saying that that is fundamentally unfair in a capital case, that the defendant, that the jury was not, in that case, given the lesser included offense.
But that was instructional error, correct?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. But the language that talks about, and let me just quote this one section. Quote, this is from Beck versus Alabama. To ensure that the death penalty is indeed imposed on the basis of reason rather than caprice or emotion, we have invalidated procedural rules that tended to diminish the reliability of the sentencing determination. The same reasoning must apply to rules that diminish the reliability of the guilt determination. We're out of time. Here, given the totality of the factual scenario that was presented to this jury and that the judge, the error that was made of presenting where the jury did not have that, when they're going through and they're looking at things, the voluntary manslaughter was not even an option for them to consider, we believe is fundamental error and one of a number of bases that, that this case should be reversed.
Why don't you request a 60-minute argument in this direct appeal of a death penalty case?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I thought when it said 30 minutes, I thought that we were given 30 minutes, and we just found out about a short time ago that it was going to be only 30 minutes for the entire argument. That was our mistake.
We have some additional questions, Justice Hardesty and then Justice Gibbons.
No, I don't have any additional questions, Chief. Thank you at this time.
Mr. Erickson, my question is this. On this verdict form, my recollection, it's been a number of years since I did this, but when you canvass the attorneys, when the judge canvasses the attorneys outside the presence of the jury regarding jury instructions and objections and makes a record on the jury instructions stuff, don't the judges also canvass on the jury form and have that approved, pre-approved before it's submitted to the jury, or is that not the way it's done there?
Your Honor, you're absolutely correct. Typically, that is the process here. Because the judge, she had wanted to take additional time to look at the issue whether she was going to allow us to include the voluntary manslaughter instruction. That she took that throughout the weekend. It was late Monday night, I guess she made her decision, and she indicates in the record that it was their error. They did not
But she didn't give you an opportunity to review it. You or the state to review it before it was submitted to the jury.
Correct, Your Honor. And that is clear in the record.
Did anybody move for a new trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Prior to the jury verdict, the jury coming back, when we realized what had been presented to them, we immediately contacted the court, and there's substantial argument. Many of these cases were presented to the judge requesting a mistrial because they should not be deliberating on this issue without the proper jury verdict.
And did you find any cases that says this is structural error? When you instruct on a verdict and then you don't give the verdict form?
Your Honor, other than the, I would argue from that Beck case that we cite, which talks about procedural error in a capital case, I guess the short answer is no. I don't know of a specific case that, other than the argument that the verdict form, I think any errors in that needs to be looked at very closely, given that it comes with the authority of the judge. And the cases we cite to talk about the problems of error or jury verdicts with errors, that because it comes from the judge, that has an unfair influence on juries, and that should be a basis.
Did the trial team hire an investigator to go talk to the jury to find out why, what they thought about being instructed on voluntary manslaughter and then not being on the verdict form?
No, Your Honor.
Could I follow up on that question? Was the jury instructed on second degree murder in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
And
that was included in the verdict form.
And that was, thank you, you covered that point. So, what do you say to the argument that had the jury been interested in some finding other than first-degree murder, it still chose not to find your client guilty of second-degree murder. Isn't that a strong indication on a harmless error analysis that the omission of the voluntary manslaughter verdict form would not have made a difference?
Your Honor, I would argue no, especially in conjunction with the judge's refusal to give the voluntary intoxication jury instruction that we believe under these circumstances was appropriate, and obviously the unfair influence of the photographs that were presented. The cumulative errors in this case, I think there's no way that that jury was able to rightfully look at this evidence and come to a correct decision. So I do understand the logic that you're getting to, but I think the totality of all of the errors make it impossible to determine that this jury had the ability to properly analyze this evidence.
Chief, may I ask a question,
please? Yes.
Sir, wasn't the jury instructed on voluntary intoxication? Didn't they have an instruction on voluntary intoxication, even if it wasn't the one that you wanted?
Your Honor, they had a very limited one, yes, but obviously not the one that we believe that the case law authorized and should have been in front of the jury.
I have one additional question. Maybe it's better handled by your co-counsel because he addressed photographs. as you know, this court on direct appeal must assess the appropriateness of the verdict. Let's assume for the moment that the court was inclined to agree with your argument that there was an abuse of discretion on the admission of some of the photographs. How would that impact the court's constitutional obligation to independently assess the appropriateness of the verdict in this case?
So if you start out with prejudice was injected through the photographs, in my argument would be then that infects every other aspect of the case, because your juror then is preloaded with a disposition to reject arguments from the defense, reject the arguments or evidence that supports the defense theory.
Maybe I didn't communicate my question very well. I'll try again. How does the error with respect to photographs affect this court's mandatory review of the death sentence, a completely independent assessment from that conducted by the jury?
I think then that the court can say, if we take out these photographs, then I guess if that's what the court is asking. If you take out the photographs, then the other aspects of the case with regard to self-defense, and to touch again on the issue of the voluntary manslaughter is without malice. And if the only verdict forms that you have are subject to a malice standard, and a court says, yeah, I'm not going to put that in there, accidentally, they don't have a jury verdict form without malice. All they have are malice, second-degree, first-degree murder. And so the question of, well, would they have gone down below a second-degree murder? Perhaps they were in their minds, and juries do things, who knows, in their minds they were thinking, well, clearly there must be malice in this case, or else the court would have given us another kind of verdict form. And it's again, so take out the photographs, give a proper instruction, appropriate verdict form, prosecutorial misconduct. I mean, this is the kind of case that is ripe for the court to hold cumulative error. And if the court is going to say this is a death penalty case, don't we certainly expect a higher standard in how these cases are put before juries than what's in this case?
Gentlemen, thank you. We're going to give you 4 minutes of rebuttal time. In this matter. Mr. Stanton.
Thank you.
If I could, in the order of the arguments presented to the court, and to go directly, Justice Terry, to your comment about how are district courts to assess photographs in cases like this. Well, I think kind of the most critical component initially in that analysis must be the relevance of the photographs to the case. And there were several comments bleeding over to other issues here, the intoxication, second-degree murder, the transitions instructions from one to the other. The state, when it was proceeding to trial, assessed that the defense of this case could come from several different areas, one of which was mentioned here this morning, that of self-defense. The other defense was a diminished mental capacity through some evidence, and I'll comment on that evidence in just a moment, of the intoxication component in this trial. But the most compelling defense from the state in anticipation of the putting on its case was what the defense was going to do about the two victims in the taxicab, and what is the evidence and how they were going to argue the state's theory of an intent to kill those individuals, whether the doctrine of transferred intent was going to be a significant component of the defense. And so the photographs, so that the record is abundantly clear, there is one photograph of each victim inside the cab. There are no other photographs that counsel is referring to that I could suggest or I think or can reasonably be argued are significantly graphic in the area of photographs that this court sees several times a year.
Mr. Stanton, weren't there autopsy photos? Deconstructed esophaguses and other pretty gruesome photographs?
There were photographs. I don't believe there were photographs of the esophageal tract. I believe there was testimony about whether or not the evidence suggested at autopsy internally whether the victims were alive based upon the forensic evidence that one sees during in a fiery inferno that they died in. So I believe there was testimony to that effect. I apologize, Your Honor, as to whether or not, because I just simply don't recall that portion of the internal exam being admitted.
Was there any reasonable, let's strike that, were they contesting at all that either the victims had burned to death or that they were alive when they burned?
Well, when you say was it contested, of course, I only know what's being contested either through cross-examination. I get some glimpse during opening, but their opening certainly didn't lend itself to where I would change this the presentation of evidence in those regards. But certainly it was important to determine whether or not they survive, the victims in the cab, survive for a protracted period of time. So that evidence was admitted, but it was significantly restricted to a testimonial context as to a visual one with photographs. But I guess the underlining issue is, does it have a compelling, relevant prong to it? And I would submit, under the unique set of facts in this case, where the two victims in the cab were not, under the facts, a intended murder victim, as was Mr. Cherry, the first victim that was shot directly by the defendant, that caused the state some concern, and that was the basis expressed to the trial court of each and every photograph that was objected to on that basis.
So how do those photographs make it more or less likely that they were intended victims?
Because I think it certainly showed a causal connection and a lack of break in a temporal context between what the jury saw on the videotape from the cabs that captured not only the initial confrontation but also the shooting. And as the evidence clearly showed, the first out of six shots was the fatal shot to Mr. Cherry. A gunshot entered on his left ribcage, exited his right. That was the only time that the defendant was on that side of the victim's car throughout the entire process from the first shot to the last shot. And so it corroborated what the video showed, that there was no break in the causal chain and the foreseeability of the issues of that, the defendant's conduct, and the deaths of the victims 2 and 3 in the cab. And I think that that, to show that there was not some other artifact that intervened that caused the defendant to now to be held to 2 counts of first-degree murder when there is no evidence of the traditional intent to kill.
Well, was there any indication something else was going to intervene?
Well, there certainly was testimony from the videotape. I guess the best way I could describe this to you, Your Honor, is that it was like a bowling ball going through pins as far as other vehicles colliding with others. And so the state's concern was, is there some argument going to be made that some other vehicle was an intervening proximate cause to
the... That wasn't part of the discussion with the court, when the court clearly expressed a concern about the cumulative nature of those photographs and the prejudicial effect. And then I understand you went through and addressed each and every photograph, and the judge made her ruling. But do you agree with the opposing counsel that this was a close case?
I don't think it was, with all due respect, because of the gravity of the case and the gravity of the penalty phase. I never like to couch or view these in easy or more difficult kind of gradations. I would submit that there was, based upon the state's evidence that was painfully and painstakingly put together, there could be little doubt that the defendant, Mr. Harris, caused Mr. Cherry's death by a single gunshot wound, and then the rest of the events occurred on videotape. So
let me ask you this. Again, understanding the gruesome nature of these photographs and the cumulative effect, why does the state push it to that point? I mean, if you've got a strong case, and you know you've got a strong case, it's on video, and why inject this?
Well, Judge, I don't see it as interjecting anything, or as the term you use, pushing the envelope, if you will, if you assess there is a strong case. This case, in fact, as it relates to the victims in the cab, caused the state significant concern. And thus, the cause and manner of their death, that there was an uninterrupted chain, that the doctrine of transferred intent applied and should apply in cases like this. A single photograph showing their cause and manner of death, I think, was not inappropriate, nor did it push the limits of what this and federal courts have outlined as what is improper photographs. And understanding that this is a, you know, their death was graphic, and there's no other way to properly show that, and that the state's entitled to. So I don't see it as pushing. I thought the state was quite restrained in the amount and nature of the presentation of this case, and to ensure that the state's theory was presented, and properly so, because this is not a typical case that even a seasoned prosecutor views, let alone 12 laypersons that have never seen or set their eyes on something like this before.
Okay. The state in its brief doesn't make any argument that if there was error, it was harmless in the admission of cumulative photographs. And that caused me concern under our Pope decision, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I believe it is harmless. I apologize that that wasn't included in our brief, because it should have. But I believe that is the correct analysis, that it is a harmless error.
Well, what do you say that it, having not been included, you've deprived Mr. Harris of the right to assess and argue against your argument on that point?
I understand the court's concern.
Thank you.
As far as in addition, and I'll move on to the verdict form. Not only was there questions of this court about were the jurors instructed on lessers included, and of course the answer was yes. They were fully instructed, absent the defective verdict form, on both the lesser included that were requested by defense counsel, second-degree murder and manslaughter. But I'd go even further to say, and incredibly important in the analysis of this court on this issue, is that there were, in addition to those instructions, there were transition instructions on how the jury was to assess and under what circumstances it could go from first to second, second to manslaughter. So it's not only the instructions of the offenses themselves, but also the transition instruction, what I think lays even a stronger argument that there is no defect about the actual verdict form because of the McNamara assessment of they're presumed to follow the instructions and detailed instructions about how to address lesser included.
But Mr. Sand, I am concerned about it, that I would think that a critical part of the trial is that each side gets to look at the verdict form. It's usually prepared by your office, is my recollection. When you did it, when the defense could go in and object to them, propose alternative jury instructions, make a record on verdict forms, make a record on verdict forms just like you do on jury instructions. That didn't happen here. It just went back there, and this is a pretty critical error. I am concerned when Mr. Langford said that maybe the jury could have assumed that without malice was off the table, though, if it wasn't, even though they were instructed to the contrary, but it does create some confusion here. So tell me why you think it's harmless.
Well, I think it's harmless, Your Honor, because of, number one, the instructions, as I just outlined, but more critically, when you look at the language in the transition instructions, and I know this court is familiar with them, about instructing laypersons about under what circumstances you must assess the jury's vote, the jury's belief of the most serious offense, first-degree murder. If you are not unanimous, then you can consider second-degree murder. And it's very specific about how that mental component goes for members of the jury to assess and then get to second-degree murder. And so if we have no impediment and no error as to second, then I would say that's strong evidence that there is no error as it relates to the manslaughter aspect of this case. And literally, if you look at the record, as I'm sure you have, the evidence of manslaughter and how it was argued was de minimis in this case. The arguments were much more suited to A, the number of murder counts of first degree, and then B, the litigation as to whether the death penalty was appropriate as a sentence in this case. As far as the prosecutorial misconduct, when Mr. Langford approached the bench and talked to the trial judge immediately after he objected in my rebuttal argument about the additional punishment for the other victims, Mr. Langford proffered that the objection that he was making was solely based upon the valuation of one life being more important than the other. And that's, of course, not what the argument is, both in its black and white meaning, nor with how I outlined it to this jury. It has been an argument that has repeatedly been approved in every capital state and under the federal system. And it is the core basis of an enumerated aggravator that was vehemently argued by the state as a compelling reason to give Mr. Harris the death penalty. And that is the number of victims involved in this case. And thus, the statement is not only factually true, it's legally appropriate, and has been recognized repeatedly as an appropriate legal argument. At no point was it argued or inferred that one of the victims' life had more meaning than others, or had specialized meaning, and thus the death penalty was appropriate under those circumstances. As far as the manslaughter, once again, there's virtually no evidence in the record, nor was it argued to this jury about evidence supporting manslaughter. And the same I would suggest to you about intoxication. There was testimony adduced of individuals that were present when the defendant was at the club, that there was a number of people both in his party and others that came to his table, and that certain amount of alcohol was purchased, I think the evidence also showed that that's kind of the standard minimum tab that you're required to purchase at these events, but there was absolutely no evidence from any source talking about the extent of intoxication of Mr. Harris during the operative time period of these events. I see my time has concluded. I thank you, and I apologize again for my delay.
Thank you.
If the court adopts the analysis that the state puts forward on why these photographs become relative, essentially what the court is saying then is that the state can come in with several straw men and say, well, this might be argued, this might be argued, and this might be argued, so these are relevant. In fact, during the argument about the photographs, the defense told the court, we were not going to say that there was some intervening event, we weren't challenging that. We weren't challenging that the people were burned to death.
I was glad you brought that up. I was going to ask you for the record site, if you could provide it later to the clerk of the court, where that dialogue took place. I thought I remembered that somewhere, but I wanted the record site on it.
It was during the argument, the contemporaneous argument with when the pictures were going to be admitted.
Right. But I couldn't remember whether it was pre-trial, during trial.
So the sequence of events, and this is the standard, there's nothing. Oftentimes when we make the argument in writing about the objecting to the photographs, the state hasn't yet chosen which photographs they want to use.
Got it.
So the court gave us leave to raise that argument again once the state had figured out which photos were. We have made the argument. We're not challenging that. We're not going to challenge that they burned to death. So tell me, how then does a photograph...
And did that argument include the fact that you're not claiming that there was intervening cause?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the site I'm requesting.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So how then does this hand out the window, which is one of the most horrific things I've ever seen, knowing that it is a mother who is a tourist in this town, the lifeblood of this town, how does that help prove something we weren't even going to argue anyway? There should be cumulative error at a minimum. In this case, it cries out for it.
Weren't there autopsy photos submitted?
There were autopsy photos submitted. There was an autopsy photo of the esophageal tract, and the reasoning for that coming in was the coroner testified that because of the way the esophagus had burned, we know that she had taken a breath. Again, how is that relevant to the cause of murder? This whole issue of that they were breathing and alive in the car, how is that relevant to the issue of murder? If not this case, what case? Thank you.
This matter will stand submitted.